All right, welcome to Willing to Fail. I'm your host as usual, Peyton Bennett, and today is a pretty cool guest. You may have heard of this little game back in the late 90s, early 2000s called Bop It, a little handheld device. This man is the inventor of it, so no further ado, welcome Dan Klitzner to the show. How are you?
Hey, thanks a lot, Peyton.
All right, so I'm always just curious on like the whole journey from creating that. I know that's not like you weren't just born with that idea, and that's just your whole life. I mean, obviously there was things before. So kind of tell me about your upbringing, where you're from, kind of your influences from your family that has molded you into the entrepreneur that you became.
Hey, thank you. That's a great way to start, because it's really, as you'll see, it's kind of a full circle of where I am now, which is that I grew up sort of artistic, drawing a lot, tinkering with a lot of things, like to work with my hands, always had ideas. But when it comes down to the family time or friends, I love playing games. You know, I love playing games. I think for me and for a lot of people, when I've given talks and asked people, what's your happiest family moment? Like, what was it that you remember? If I said, what's the most valuable moments and where you were truly happy? It's amazing how many people say they were playing a game, you know, of some kind at a party with friends around the table. They don't say, oh, having dinner or, you know, doing homework with my parents or whatever. You know, they almost, a very high percentage say, we were sitting around playing cards, playing a game. You know, there's something about playing games with people that puts you in a state where it gets embedded in your memory in such a way that the longer it goes, the more people value those memories. And I mean, just to jump to, I went into industrial design, went to a school called Art Center College of Design, in a journey to get there. I went into engineering, was unhappy. My father actually found out about that there was this thing called industrial design, which is not engineering. It's the, you know, well, the best way to explain industrial design is, a lot of people don't know what it is. You say, what are they? It's in designing. And I said, well, we all know what architects do, right? If I ask you, so what do architects design?
They just design buildings or structures. Yeah.
We design everything else.
Okay.
So it's hard to explain, because it's kind of like everything. You know, you can look around your room. It could be a chair. It could be a microphone. It could be a, you know, the water pitcher. Like, it's just people who design the thing, not the engineers, but the aesthetic, the ergonomics, you know, and toys, of course, are one of those things. But I went in as an industrial designer, very interested in inventing and creating and really designing aesthetically what things looked like, you know, very slick looking blenders, I don't know, something, you know, that got me excited. But industrial design applied to games is very different. Board games and things like that, which I'd love, or card games, you know, are much more about paper and boards. So if you really want to look to how I got into toy invention, it's really through the very much more industrial design side. So that's why Bop It is kind of a mix of someone who loves games. It's a device that you play with that's really more of a product than it is, you know, a typical game. So I feel it came through that process. Bunch of other stuff that I've done. I've done, you know, many. Perplexus is another one that I've done with another partner, and it's a very, you know, this one probably, where there's a maze with ball inside. You know, it's really more like a sculpture. You know, to me, the type of things as an industrial designer I want to create are games that you would leave out on your table, like a beautiful, you know, there's one of these we did that's all white, and it looks like something that you leave out, you wouldn't just put in a cupboard when you're not playing with it. So that's where my industrial design side meets the game side.
That's interesting, because yeah, I have a friend that kept that on like their coffee table, and I just picked it up one time and we just started playing with it. So I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
So you were you doing all that like engineering stuff like on your own at a young age, or were you just waiting until you like you worked for a company later down the road? How did that all start for you?
Well, I went to school as in engineering, and like I said, graduated, but transferred halfway through, graduated from Art Center, and had some jobs, really freelance jobs. I never really worked for another company out of school. I was a freelancer, had actually worked on a lot of bottle designs starting out as a consulting, you know, freelance designer. In fact, there's some of them are still out today. I designed through there was a bigger company that did the graphic identity for things like Clorox, and they did a lot of liquor bottles. So one of them that's still around is, if you know Woodford Reserve bourbon, that's a bottle I designed 30 something years ago. There's a Clorox, one of the original toilet bowl cleaner under the, there's a picture of me with this original bottle. You know, they were ergonomic bottles that had an aesthetic to them. I didn't do the graphics. I did the shapes of those. So I actually had quite a few. There's one called Corbett Canyon, a wine bottle. So these are unusual shaped bottles that I designed. And that was sort of my side, my steady clients were clients that I designed bottles for. Had another client that was Memorex, where I was doing remote controls for them. They were starting to do universal remotes, and those are remotes that could work with any TV. That was a new thing at the time. And while I was doing that, another freelance client, I had entered an ad in the paper for a company called Discovery Toys, which was a kind of an in-home sales organization, kind of like Tupperware, you know, where they'd have a party. Moms would throw a party at a house, usually moms, and would have try to sell baby products to, and they wanted to do their, they had imported things, they wanted to do their own products. So like this little rattle was one of the first things I did. It's just like a really nicely designed teething rattle, but little sense of humor. There's peanuts in the rattle are actually peanuts, because everyone knows elephants eat peanuts, you know. So this is sort of how I started, was with clients like this, doing remote controls, doing as an industrial design freelancer, designing products. While I was at this company, Discovery Toys, I did probably, there was a marble run I did, like a big thing that's still out there today, Marble Works Grand Prix, things that were very three-dimensional and sort of inventive, you might say, beyond just a design. And I heard that you could, in the toy industry specifically, pitch toy ideas to companies and they would license them and you could get a royalty on them. And I thought that sounded pretty exciting, and I had a lot of ideas. So as I was still had them as a client, but one of the products I had worked on was they wanted to do a new shovel, and I designed this shovel that was like, you put your hand in an ergonomic sand digger. No one had done something like this before. And so I thought it was pretty cool. I built a mock-up and started testing it. And they didn't want to do it. It wasn't right for them. So I went out and looked for how could I license this to someone. And I found a little company, licensed it to them. And it started to do pretty well. But at the time, I thought they were going to patent it. They thought I was going to patent it. I really hadn't done a licensing deal before. Wasn't sure how that worked. So it never was patented. And it started to get knocked off everywhere. And this is over 30 years ago. It's everywhere. I go all over the world. I see these on beach. So although you might say, rather than being, if you talk about learning from failure, well, this was sort of a success that had I failed at doing my homework to know, you know, if I had patented this, of course, it would have been better financially. But I learned a lot from that. You know, I besides I'm proud to see it everywhere, honestly, like shareware, I'm kind of like, wow, that's pretty cool that the first thing I licensed is still out there and growing strong today and people know it, you know? So how do you turn that failure into something that I use later? Well, I never made that mistake again.
I bet.
You know, I went in and went on to build more relationships in the toy industry after that and start to meet everyone and pitch. And, you know, every company is different. What they're looking for is different. So a lot of that was getting to know what is each company looking for and how to pitch them the ideas that they might license.
Okay. So that was like kind of your first ideas. How much longer down the road until you came out with Bop It?
Bop It was 90. I invented Bop It in 95, licensed it in 96. This was probably 1992. It was only a few years before that. I had also had several other things between this and Bop It, I think I probably licensed 10 or 12 other games. Okay. One of the things that people don't remember really, but that's what I've been posting on my social media, like, believe it or not, this was, you know, something that was out there that failed, but it, those were this one called Go-Go Worms, which you extruded Play-Doh into these worm shapes and raced each other. It was, you know, like each year I kind of was meeting more companies, and the lesson there is that I was building relationships with those companies. So the company I licensed this Go-Go Worms to was Milton Bradley. And when you first meet with companies, they'll often have a person, you know, who's maybe more like a scout looking for ideas. Because in the toy industry, they're looking for ideas. So unlike other industries, you can pitch. But you don't kind of go up the tier to the head of marketing or something until you're sort of in their top level of inventors. So I had licensed that, and it did okay. And I had pitched some other good ideas. And then the head, this guy named Bill Dorman, who just passed away last year, unfortunately, he was the head of marketing. And I heard he was coming to California to look for meet with people on invention. And I kind of wanted to meet with him because he was sort of the top guy. And at the time, so they took the meeting, and that's when I pitched Bop It to him. It was in this totally different form that I think some people have probably seen because I posted a lot on it. It was in this form as this hammer that you hammered on the table, hammer up, you hammered to bop it, you twisted, and you pulled it. It started, we're going to backtrack a little. Well, I'll finish the story first. The story with Bill Dorman was that he looked at this, and I had a mock-up of it. I had him try it, even though it was just sort of a video mock-up with this non-working model that you could kind of play. And he said, wow, we're not doing anything like this. We're not. He said, but we should, you know. And that was like a really important moment because he was at a top level, he could say, we're not, but we should. If it was a lower, you know, if it was someone else who was more of a scout, they'd be like, no, we're not doing stuff like that. You know, so the difference wasn't whether it was a great idea or not. It was whether you run into the right person at the right time with the right company, with the right idea, like thinking of all the things that had to be right for that to work. Is looking back, I'm like, well, it's luck, but it's also through having built those relationships. I never would have met with him if I hadn't had an earlier sort of semi-success that sort of failed, but I built the relationship. So I think that's an important, you know, that opportunity wouldn't have been there if I hadn't have built it over a few years before.
Yeah, that's what I remember learning in like an entrepreneur class in college called like the corridor effect, where basically you go down the hallway of the path you want to go down, you keep opening doors, and eventually those doors will lead to other doors that can go in a way you didn't imagine, but going down the right path, going the right way. So what do you think he meant by they won't, but they should?
Well, he just said, we're not doing anything like this now. Meaning they were Milton Bradley. They did board games. You know, people know they had Twister. They had Candyland. They had Monopoly. They had things that people think of as board games. The game Simon had come out before Bop It, which people know. That was the only other sort of, there was electronic game. There was one called Merlin. You know, there have been other around that era. There were, or right, 10 years before maybe, there had been this surge of electronic games in the 80s, but they weren't doing them anymore is what he meant. We're really focused on things, licenses, like they'd want to do, you know, the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire game, or they're a big company that needed big, well-known things. Star Wars figures, you know. So I think what he meant by it was, you know, we're really not looking for things like this. But what came out of his mouth was, we're not doing anything like this. But when he first said it, I really thought he meant, but the fact that he turned and he goes, but we should, was his level of vision. So having a great champion who sees your vision is, you know, over 50% of that equation, not just, oh, I have a great idea, you know. Well, that's a small part of.
Yeah. When I just talked to the founder of Reebok, he referred to people in his life as gatekeepers. Basically, like, even you could do the right things and have the right ideas, you're going to go around in circles unless you meet a gatekeeper that can take you to the next level and introduce you to, or open a door for you, or open a gate for you.
It's exactly it. It's, you know, and you really have to be conscious of that. It's the part, I think I've mentioned to you before, this call was, I have this acronym called RIGHT. You can't really sell your idea until everything is right. And that stands for R-I-T-E. And I made up this acronym. I was going to give a talk at a school. And I thought, well, I better sound smart. I better come up with some acronym that sounds like I know what I'm talking about. And honestly, I first said, you can't sell an idea until it's right. And I didn't know what it would mean. I just knew there was an I. I said, well, the I is obviously the idea is the I. And I didn't. Then it just sort of occurred to me, well, what would the R be? And I said, well, it's relationships. You know, that if you think of the R-I-T-E as I've given this example of, you know, if this is a table and there's four legs underneath this table, think of them as R, I, T, and E. And the idea is to build this table as high as possible with the R, I, T, and E. Don't let it be lopsided by just saying, I have a great idea and it's just one leg of the table, then the idea falls off, you know? So R for relationship really deserves to come first before the I. For that reason is what you just said, the corridor effect, the thing of over a much more time, you could be failing at a lot of things. You could be failing at, I've failed 10 times more than I've succeeded with concepts. So pitching ideas, but so you call it, someone calls it a failure. Like, well, what did you build towards that leg of the table while you were failing? You were building that leg pretty high. So now you better have an idea that's as good as, like, it just as high as that. Like, think of, like, you want to keep matching. And then the T was timing. Timing is not luck. Timing is also a studied understanding of the market. When should you pitch an idea, right? You know, the R is who should you pitch it to. The I is the idea, and the T is timing. And E is a really tricky one that I call execution, meaning
that's an important one.
Yeah, like probably, I mean, what would you call execution in terms of entrepreneurs' ideas?
I mean, execution is like, to me, I think that's the most important part, because you could have the best idea and even good timing, but if you don't put the work in and like work hard at it and get things right and execute on it, it's not going to mean anything.
Yeah, that's right. It's execution of, do you execute, how will you execute? And in terms of design, it's literally, you could give 10 designers the same idea, same relationship, same timing, RIT, what's the E? You know, they may have 10 different interpretations on it. So often you'll hear people say, I had that idea. That was my idea. I had that same idea. Really? Are you sure you had the E part of that idea? Like, because a lot of people have the same idea at the same time. We all think of many things at the same time, but that's the variable, that the details matter, you know, and that R mattered because I had a relationship, you know, the right person saw it, the right idea, the right timing, meaning we're not doing these, but we should. So the timing was right. Yeah. We've got six of these kind of projects in house right now. We are, you know, that's what that meant, is it was time for that innovation. The timing was perfect. And it was somehow, it wasn't executed perfect in terms of, well, often when you pitch an idea to a company, you know, they license the idea and then they design it in-house. The in-house designer was the one who really brought this into this form. You know, it's exactly the same concept. It's just he was responsible for having this execution. I wasn't involved that much in this final part. On the other Bop-Its, everything since then, I've done almost, you know, a ton of that stuff. But in this initial one, I was lucky to have that.
So your original one was like the hammer shape that you brought into them, and then they turned it into like the one, just the long one that you just showed?
Yeah. It's what's really interesting now is, I'll go with you just a slight backstory on failure. As you're saying, this didn't start as a game of Bop-It. I've shared this a few times, that it started as a remote control. So I was doing remote controls for Memorex. That was way back in my story there. While I was designing and said, oh, these universal remotes are pretty cool, at the same time I was working on toy ideas. And I thought, could there be a remote control for kids that was a lot more physical? Like something that made you move. That's been a lot of the themes of the products I've invented, are how the product's purpose is to make the person move. If you flip it around, it really changes your perception of you know, the as if the product is instructing the person to be animated. That's kind of what I call it. Versus, so when you think of a remote control, you're just using your thumb, kind of like we do with cell phones, right?
So you were kind of ahead of the game before, like, the Nintendo came out with the Wii and was moving the remote and that stuff.
10 years or whatever it was, 5 years before that, it was definitely intentionally how to do a remote that you had to swing and move. So this was, you banged it on the table for channel up, you banged the other side for channel down. This was volume. You twisted the volume knob and you just pulled it on off. It was like it was a simplest remote possible. Literally just, I thought it was funny that you could be banging it on the table to change channels. This was before we had 700 channels.
Yeah, I bet parents would have loved that. Their kids just bang on the table, changing the channel.
Soft. I wanted to do them a soft material, but yeah, it would have been funny. So I did other remotes at the time. I probably have some around. I did this line called Remotes Out of Control. That actually did get licensed, the Remotes Out of Control. But I had like a surfboard, a potato, couch potato, a pizza. It was called Remote by the Slice. It was this funny, I should have had them prepped here. But anyway, you can look them up in there. They actually got sold. I licensed them to a company. But they didn't want the hammer because it was probably too unconventional, you know, the idea of banging it on the table. So that actually is how Bop It came about, was when another company had called, built from another relationship, Tiger Electronics, which did a lot of these LCD games. And they said, do you have any new ideas for LCD games? And I thought about it. And I looked over at this hammer that had been rejected. It was a failure for the remote. And I thought, well, maybe that's a game, not a remote control. You know, just by listening to someone's thought and said, well, that could be a more physical LCD game. So I actually tried it. Initially, there was a screen on it, tried to make a game where you swung it, but you obviously can't see what's on the screen while you're swinging it. That's how it changed to lights and audio originally. The lights, more like a game of Simon, were not just there was a cost with lights. It was also too much like what Simon was, and it was, as a memory game, it just wasn't it wasn't that fun somehow to do the memory game with gestures. And it was really the biggest epiphany that I've sort of said was this thought, like, what if it was just like, I tried three moves at a time, two moves at a time with just audio, and it was this thing like, what if it was just one move at a time, you know? And it felt, oh, you'll never get it wrong. But I did a soundtrack and did sort of a test with this foam core model. And you could just tell, like, if you speed it up, you'll probably get confused at some point. But, you know, it seems obvious because people, but that's what makes Bop It fun, was this sort of counterintuitive thing. Like, well, why do you get it wrong? Right? Why do you, I told you what to do. It's kind of like people say, oh, I told you. Why didn't you do what I said? Well, Bop It is proof that people sometimes have good intentions. They just do something different.
Especially when you get the anxiety of, like, it's speeding up and you can hear it getting louder or faster.
Yeah, it was sort of, but that's the luck of, well, but it is asking, you know, from the lesson in it, it was several failures on the way to Bop It that were turned into successes by taking them as building blocks and just knowing there was something there that was unusual. It animated people in a fun way. And just the luck of listening to the right thing at the right time and saying, well, what if it was this? What if it was that? And following your gut, if there's something there and you go, it's not there yet, that execution part that you go, well, I'm just going to keep trying some things and see if I'm right. And it's, you know, the fun of being right is the RITE, you know, okay, everything's right, you know.
Yeah, you definitely have that classic entrepreneur story of, like, the different failures just kind of getting you right on the right path to get to that one, like, I guess your big breakthrough hit being Bop It. My question is, I know you've had other ideas before that. Looking back at all the ideas you've had, what do you think was the stupidest one?
Well, stupidest, there's plenty of, they're all stupid ideas. They wouldn't be boys if they weren't stupid, you know? That's the whole goal. There is one that failed miserably. It wasn't a stupid idea, but it was a big idea that was probably one of the biggest failures. It's the electronic Slinky.
Hi, I'm Slinky, and it's time to stare.
This was a product that literally has electronic luminescent tape in it, as you can see. It's got tilt sensors, so it knows what it's doing. And it has a voice, as annoying as that is, it's got a voice that tells you things like, it was sort of Bop It meets Slinky, to be honest. And what's crazy about it is, look at this manufacturing. This was done with a company called Spin Master, an amazing, innovative company, and they took a chance on this. And there's something like, 250 screws screwing all. This isn't a flexible material. This is plastic that's like, I don't know how they manufactured it. You know, and there's wire and tape. Just the amount of manufacturing in this, to get this effect, was kind of unbelievable that this company went for it. It was actually tested quite well on TV and tests. It failed because it was just like most toys, many toys fail just due to cost, because people's perception is like, well, let me ask you, how much should this cost?
Like $19.
There you go. Perfectly unrehearsed answer. It could not make money unless it sold for $25.
Yeah.
So the problem was this crazy thing, lots of fun, whatever, but it was impossible to make money unless they sold it for $25. When they lowered it to $20 for clearance, it blew out, whatever, everyone bought it. But the problem was they couldn't sell it at $24.99. And that's one of the hardest things in the toy industry, is there's a lot of technology in some of these toys, and it's not getting any easier, and people still expect a game to be $20.
Yeah, that makes sense. And how was finding the pricing point for Bop It? How did that go?
I didn't determine it at the time. It was $20 25 years ago. Right? It was $20. That's sort of been, what's weird is that price hasn't changed in 25 years for toys. Think of cars, think of rent, think of food, think of coffee, lattes. They're all four times the amount. A $20 toy should be $80 now if it kept up with inflation, but it hasn't. So it really is. That's why you'll see a lot of products just not be very well made, is there's just no margin in them. So it's a very hard industry in a way to make money on anymore, because everyone's taking smaller and smaller margins because the consumer perception is that it should be cheaper than it really costs.
Interesting. Okay, so then, I mean, the first Bop It came out $20, and then I know there's other like variations of it that came out, and you said those are more like your ideas, like more close to your ideas.
Well, they were all my, I'm just saying the difference in the DNA of an invention is sort of one thing. It's kind of like if I said if Bop It was a movie, I would be, based on the book by Dan Kutzner, whatever, it's like but the final execution was like a whole slew of people that made Bop It in product, so an idea person often gives an idea like me. It's the DNA of that original idea has stuck through all the Bop Its. It's just that starting with after the first one, I didn't do the industrial design on it. I got more involved in all the follow-ups, and me and my group, I have partners, Gary and Brian at Kid Group. We've done the coding, we've done the like tons, thousands of time more work on every other subsequent Bop It than the first one. Because at that point, it's now a line that we could develop, and Bop It Tetris and Bop It Smash and Bop It Beats. There's been, 20 different variations, and we've done a lot of the production on those personally.
So of all of those, I was going to ask, of all those, which one like was your favorite or the one you're most proud of?
I'm still, the original is my favorite.
That's just because
it's a classic, but to be honest, but the Bop It Extreme, which was next, I think they just have different personalities. And as far as a game that's a really addictive, kind of a cross between a video game and Bop It, if you've never played Bop It Tetris, this thing is amazing. The programming in it. This was this concept of crossing. I love Tetris, and I always thought there was a correlation between Bop It and Tetris, because they're both like a relentless game, right? Things are falling in Tetris. You got to keep up. It gets faster. There was a physical component of with arrow keys on your computer trying to twist the shapes. Like it kind of had a twisty thing. So I had this idea to say, what would happen if we mixed Bop It and Tetris? it'd be a physical way to play Tetris. And I mocked it up with stop motion, actually, a little mock-up to see how it looked and if it was understandable. And eventually it turned into this thing that only uses 12 LEDs. This came out about 10 years ago. And so you're trying to match these shapes. Let's see. So you've got to move it over. Whoops. You're trying. Hard to do in reverse. So I'm, see how I'm dropping the lights?
Gotcha.
And what happens is eventually you can turn, you can actually turn the shape here before you drop it.
That looks so difficult.
See this? You know, I can turn it. And then, so it is literally a physical way to take the Tetris pieces and change them and compress them. Just as a gameplay, it's so intricate. There's so many levels. It goes on. There's no, like, you can't, it doesn't end. It goes on and on until someone can get a high score. So it's much more like a video game experience. And I'd say of all the Bop-Its, it's the cleanest, most original gameplay outside of the original Bop-It.
So is like that version or some of even the older ones, are they still selling today or have some of them like basically been shelved?
They kind of go in rotation. Often they're shelved. We're talking about trying to bring this one back, or Hasbro is, because now with Amazon and stuff, they can maybe make a limited run and just have some available, but they don't have to do the marketing like they do. When you launch a new product, it's got to be a full-on product launch with tons of marketing and they can't just leave everything on the shelf. As you know, it just, things have to move. And so after the initial couple of years, they'll pull things out of production. And often that's why we come up with the new one, the next new one.
And a question about like the business side of it. So when you go to like Hasbro or these companies and you pitch these ideas, are you just worried about just getting your product out there and that's all you care about? Or is you want like a good, are you fighting for like a strong royalty deal or do you want like money up front or what's like, how does the business side of that handled?
Yeah, business side, first of all, as a business model, remember my initial business model was I was an industrial designer, had freelance clients, had enough work to kind of keep myself and a couple people busy. So I originally started this by speculating on ideas in between paying projects. Since so I already had a shop, I was already building stuff, getting paid for it. It was easy to slide in some ideas in between that and not really take a risk, right? Mm-hmm. Except for the time to meet with people. That's a different model. Maybe it's 50%, 70% paid work, 30% speculation, using the same skill set, right? As both. That was a neat model. I really like that. It's a model. If you're going to be an inventor and you're doing things with your hands and you know, don't quit your day job. Because the model for an inventor goes like this. You know, you speculate. No one's paying you to come up with ideas. Even if a company gives share, sometimes they'll share a wish list, which doesn't mean that much, to be honest. You know, it's, we're looking for things for 7-year-olds that promote outdoor play. You know, well, it's not giving you the answers. They're just saying these are categories we want. Then you meet with people, and when you pitch an idea, whether you've prototyped it, done a great video, you know, you have to make a great pitch for your idea. If a company likes it, they'll probably want to hold it for a grace period, like a couple weeks to a month, to decide if they want to option it. If you option it an idea, similar to a scriptwriter, if you option a script to a company, it means they're not committing to it, but they don't want anyone else to see it or have it. So they kind of, an option might be a typical, would be around a $5,000 for a month to then hold it exclusively.
Okay.
If at the end of that option period, they haven't decided, they can either option it for another month or return it to you and you keep the money because they took it off the market really for that month. Or they can decide to move forward with a license agreement. A license agreement is a much more complex agreement where you are negotiating terms like the royalty rate and the term, the termination. You know, how do you get your idea back is one of the most important things in any contract. How do you get it back if the company is either not performing or they've done, you know, like they're, once they license your idea, they can kind of do anything they want with it usually, except not do it.
Yeah.
You know, time limit. And if they don't produce it by a certain time, so a license agreement has a much bigger upfront payment, usually based on around 25% of the first year's anticipated royalties.
Okay.
So some products that might be $10,000, some it might, maybe you can push for a $50,000 advance on a really big idea. Hard to get more than that today. And these are big, big numbers, very rarely. So people don't get all excited like they're just going to show an idea and make $50,000. This is a whole process of lots and iterations and negotiations. And so, but I like to share the numbers. These are the numbers. You know, these are real numbers that are hard to come by, but it does happen. Then, you know, you're waiting a year or 2 years for the product to come out. Once that, because it's, you know, you've sold an idea, it goes into development, this, it's, you know, many people are working. Now I'm pitching ideas now for 2022 or 2023 that companies, you know, and so your contract would be that once they produce it, they'll pay you a royalty. Average is around 5% of wholesale. So if a product is going to sell for $20 and the wholesale was $12, you're getting 60 cents per product.
Interesting. Minus
some deductions. There's all sorts of other stuff they take out of it.
For sure. So
the business model, basically, which you can see is such a long pipeline that you need, and that it's, you know, it's very hard. If you don't succeed right away, you're dead in the water. You don't have income. If you're not getting a lot of, like, I have hundreds of ideas that I'm constantly pitching, you're hoping to get enough options to sort of pay for the time to spend on other things, but you can go dead in the water for long periods and have zero income.
So when you first pitched and were doing the deal for Bop It, what were the expectations at that point? I can't imagine it was the expectations. I had to imagine it's way higher. It exceeded expectations.
Oh yeah. I mean, Bop It's an extremely rare, one of the rarest products in 25 years, you know, for its,
yeah.
Here, 25 years later, we're still working on new versions. I'm still, yeah, it's, I think maybe it's hard in 25 years, it might be one of the only ones that's happened to. So, it was typical, like expected. A big company might expect, if they're going to commit to a product and put TV behind it, they're going to expect it to do at least 250,000 units in it. So they base everything on that. They don't really expect things to do like this is going to sell a million units. They never build a model to expect that, but they have to be ready if it does.
Okay. How many, do you know how many units of like the original Bop It or Bop It in total have sold?
Yes.
What is it?
I don't know exactly. Honestly, I don't know that anyone, because there's been so many versions, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, now we're doing, you know, Bop It characters, which is an idea.
These,
you know, have you seen these that you twist and pull the characters?
I've not seen those.
You there's a new Baby Yoda one out that everyone wants.
I was gonna say that one probably do well.
You twist, you bop, twist, and you pull. So this was an idea from many years ago, which was how to bopify any character. So there's those. There's, you know, this Bop It Beats, which was supposed to be a turntable based Bop It. So when you say how many Bop Its have sold, it's really the universe of all the things that, you know, again, I've been deeply involved in with my partners in the developing of all of those, still licensed to Hasbro, but in terms of kind of coming up with the next thing. And I think, you know, in the course of 25 years, the estimate is there's probably been 30 million Bop Its of different kinds sold in 30 years.
And how many of just the original one?
That original one sold, I'm sure a few million sold in the first few years. It was selling at about a million units a year. And again, when people, you know, one of the most common questions, how much did you make on Bop Its? Well, I've been in business 25, you know, it's kind of like, not to draw an analogy, but it is a bit like asking Steve Jobs, how much did you make on the Macintosh? You know, like he had no one else to pay or no one else to work
with.
Great. If you're an inventor and you just happen to come up with an idea and pitch it and walk away and never touch it again and never try to run your business for 25 years. But, you know, I have an invention studio. We've had employees, you know, it helped me launch, and I already had a business at the time. So I like to say for entrepreneurs, you know, it's not what you make, as you know, it's what you keep. And try, yeah, there's lots of failures that a success often has to pay for, as you know.
Yeah. Well, hope you're doing all right financially. It seems like you got a bunch of ideas that did pretty well. What before I let you go, it's been awesome talking to you, learning, just picking your brain. What ideas do you have that you're most excited about for the future that you can talk about, or maybe ideas in your head that haven't even gone to paper yet?
Well, there's a few really fun games that are hopefully I can't talk about, but they're really great. Yeah, I love coming up with games, mechanical things. I'm pitching ideas all the time. But the one thing I would like to say is, so to be grateful, because I have been lucky and successful with Bopit, even though have it, as I said, plenty of flops to counterbalance it. But I've started this thing to celebrate this year. That's why I'm on social media, to connect with fans. I want to hear their Bopit stories. Honestly, it's the part that's so exciting, is to know there's millions of people that have some, every time I hear some great memory they have, that full circle, as I said, that's why I started this. I had great memories with my family, friends, brother, sister, those bonding moments. And I absolutely love hearing those. So I'm working on a book for this year that is going to hopefully celebrate the 25 years. And if people are sending me comments on social media, I'm trying to put in my favorites into the book. I'm also telling the history of Bopit in that, and also just a little bit about this RITE, like some wisdom of what I think I learned from inventing, or just tips about that. So I'm busy on that, on the book. And also on this thing I've started called Bopit for Good. It's a online website store where I'm designing original art, Bopit art, putting it on, you know, cool beanies, sweatshirts. Here's a beanie. Okay. And then they all say Bopit with the word for good, because it's basically a not-for-profit. I want to give back by raising money for children's arts and design, so that there might be, you know, finding organizations that don't have the advantage I had, having a, you know, finding my way. And I think there's lots of creative people out there. So trying to look for that, that's where Bopit's going to give back with this Bopit for Good.
That's awesome. That's it's great to give back. It's cool that that's like what really drives you. Last question before I let you go is, what did you think about the SNL skit that they did on the Bopit or whatever it was, like earlier last year? Did you see that?
There's been many, many Bopit spoofs and skits. That's not the first Bopit skit, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure there's been a lot.
It focuses on the word pull it quite well with Tina Fey and Amy Poehler. They're pretending that it's a new product and she's testing it, and all it says is pull it. You can imagine how fun that is. And so they did that. They've done a couple of skits with Bopit, and the Bopit was totally unexpected. That wasn't paid for. That was just evidence that there's people that grew up with Bopit that are writers.
Yeah.
And who just think it's funny to spoof it. And that's usually in The Simpsons. There was a really great spoof on Bopit after I actually met Matt Groening and talked to him at a conference, and then he later came out with that. So I think it was a little bit like a dig that it's well, the part that came from was when people say how many Bopits have sold, I've said, well, like 30 million Bopits have sold. So who doesn't love Bopit, right? And the answer is 60 million parents.
That's a good one. So,
as they say, it's the world's most annoying game if you're a parent.
And yeah,
he took that and put it in a really funny opening. If you look up Bopit Simpsons, there's this fantastic thing where they're playing in the car and Homer's all upset and he throws it out the window. And just as he does that, another family's having the same experience in their car, and the father throws their Bopit out the window, but it goes right into the Simpsons car and lands back in Bart's lap, and he keeps playing it, you know, like so clever. But it was such an honor, like, wow. My invention was just spoofed on The Simpsons. You know, that's probably a highlight.
That's cool. Do they contact you before, or you just find out about it? You just watch The Simpsons, just pops up?
No, they usually change the name, like Bonk It or Boop It, or it's a parody, you know, so they don't have to contact you. So those are great moments. And, you know, connecting with you, connecting with people, just talking about the, you know, I said, I'm mostly grateful, would love to help people who, by just talking about what, you know, this is a very, very personal journey but a lot of people can probably learn from, I like what you're saying with, you know, willing to fail. That's what this is. This is failing for every little bit of success, but really listening and understanding what people's feedback is, being willing to just jump, being willing to throw out whatever you're working on if there's something better. That's probably the biggest thing about failure is you just spent 6 months on something, but someone said something, you go, you know what? You gotta have a gut feel that's, you can't dwell on what you did. You have to move forward.
Like turning a failed TV remote into a toy.
Exactly.
So what, just for anyone, I know people that they can look forward to your book coming out, where can they find you on social media? Where's the best place to see you?
Well, the best place for, I think, the most fun content is the TikTok. It's at Bop It Inventor. Just because I'm meeting a lot of celebrities, a lot of people who love Bop It, and they're doing all sorts of fun things with it. And where I'm just sort of egging people on. I'm telling some invention stories. I think I have a 1 minute Bop It invention story there that was very popular. I'm trying to go through like 60 Bop It concepts that didn't make it in 1 minute. Like stuff that's just, I've got archives of stuff. And then, you know, maybe once in a while, a little tip on inventing. But it's kind of the idea that's a great platform to just get instant feedback, lots of comments, which I love to hear. I'm talking to the guy who did the voice of Bop It, Buddy Rubino. We're talking about maybe doing some fun surprises on that. Like really, it's a celebration of whatever Bop It fans want to see and hear. I'm kind of trying to answer those questions. And so that's good. It's the same handle on Instagram at Bop It Inventor. I'm posting kind of the same stuff, but there's a little bit different crowd, a little more adult there, I'd say. Yeah. And on Twitter, there's the same mirrored, but again, each platform's a little different.
But all right. All right. Well, I appreciate you coming on, Dan. It was cool talking to you, and I'll definitely be following along on social media. You may see me commenting from different accounts.
Thanks, Peyton. It's been awesome. I know, I love that you're doing this on Willing to Fail. It really speaks to me.
Appreciate it. I figured you fit right along with the theme.
All right, man.
I'll stay in touch. See you, man.
See ya. Bye.